That. So Sadie just asked a really good question, which is at the heart of the problem of norms, which is, in a world where men don't do much childcare, how much praise should they be given when they do it? So I take care of my grandniece on Friday afternoons when I'm able to. So, you know, not every week, but probably roughly every other week. And has since they moved to Madison when she was 1.5, and she's 6 now. And when I would go over to her house, and part of our routine is to go for walks. So we went for pretty long walks. So we'd be walking on Monroe Street, and I'd be holding this little girl's hand when she was 3 years old or so. And I would get such adoring looks from people. Now, partially people give adoring looks when they see anybody with a little kid. But unquestionably, I think I was getting extra points because I was a guy walking hand in hand with an adorable little girl, right? I mean, a kid. I don't think it had anything to do with it being Ella, a little girl. I mean, maybe there's even a little extra frisson of around that, but okay. The same thing in around the division of labor within a family over cleaning up the kitchen, right? So there is this constant thing, and sometimes in the literature on housework described as the battle of the sexes, in which even when the work is divided 50-50 in terms of the amount of time, the standards by which women like to have a kitchen cleaned up on average are higher than the standards that men have. Not universally. Again, there's an overlapping distribution. There are some fastidious men and some sloppy women, of course. So, but on average, women want a cleaner kitchen at the end of the cleanup period than men do. And then the question is, when the man starts doing it at the standard of the wife in a heterosexual couple, blah, 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 should she praise him for it or not? Because it should be just expected. Now, I think if you're in a historical moment of transforming norms, you should praise people for violating the expectation. Because the affirmations and sanctions in the world are working in the other direction. And part of what you're trying to do is actually change expectations. And to change expectations, people who are going against the norms should be praised, even if they ought to have been doing it all along. Right? That's part of the... And that's how norms work. I mean, the way norms become salient and become embodied and become then part of common sense and your habit is because they've been praised when you do it right and sanctioned when you do it wrong. And in the world we happen to live in, because of the gendering of norms, it just turns out, I think men do need positive reinforcement for doing it. I don't think on balance that reinforces the notion that the normal thing is for women to do it, and aren't you cute because you're in sweet because you're doing it. I mean, it may have a little bit of that effect of validating the conventional thing, but I think the bigger effect is reinforcing the desirability of deviance from it. But this, you know, all of this is bound up with some pretty complicated matters around transformations of cultural forms, which I think mostly sociologists just wave their hands at. You know, people have all sorts of arguments about how culture changes, but really it's pretty tough to nail this down. You know, how would you do a study which would establish whether, on balance, praising men for doing a good job in their housework reinforces the norms that women are the natural givers of doers of housework and men are doing it because they're special, as opposed to undermining the gender division of labor by creating a greater willingness of men to do it? Yeah, I don't know how you could possibly empirically sort it out. Okay. Four aspects of micro foundations. So when you study the micro foundations of people's actions, then there's sort of four things you explore. There's the micro mechanisms of consciousness formation, the mechanisms through which preferences, information, and theories are produced and internalized. So that's the micro formation of ideologies. A lot of discussions of propaganda, of education, Terborn's affirmations and sanctions, a lot of that is all about how preferences, information, and theories are produced and then internalized in particular subjectivities. Then, of course, there's the micro mechanisms of non-consciousness formation. These are the mechanisms through which all the non-conscious processes that we've talked about are formed and transformed. This is the micro formation of personality, of habits. A lot of Bourdieu's arguments are really about that, not about ideology. His habitus is more about the installation of these non-conscious dimensions of subjectivity. And it's one of the kind of criticisms of Bourdieu, is that agency gets very thin in his perspective, because the explanation for why people do what they do is much more because of their underlying habits of disposition that are inscribed in them in these non-conscious ways, so that it's much more people are following scripts than that they are the authors of their own activity. Third, there's the micro process of choice making. We've talked about that when we've looked at collective action problems and free riding, and sort of game theory is all about the micro processes of choice making, how strategies are formed. One class of this model, of this process with relatively simple assumptions about cognition, is the rational actor model of various sorts. But I think you should think of rational actor models as just one interesting subset of all possible models of the microprocesses by which people make the choices that they make. And finally, and this is, I think, the least developed, but in certain respects, I think, ultimately could prove to be among the more important problems to work on. It's the microprocesses of creative action, of problem solving, rather than just choice making. Simple choice is usually understood as a choice among options, where you have means and ends, you've got the ends given, you've got a set of constraints, and you're asking how people align their means to their ends. In creative action, a lot of what's in play is involves the co-evolution of means and ends. Problem solving is often a question of understanding what are the real ends of action for which a problem is a solution should be sought, rather than what, given a fixed set of ends, is the optimal solution. There's a German social theorist named Hans Joas, J-O-A-S, who's written a really interesting book on the problem of creative action. Creativity in Action, I think, is the title of the book. His work is in the tradition of Dewey, sort of Deweyan pragmatism in the United States. Dewey, as a philosopher, pragmatic action, his pragmatic theory, is one in which he sees ends of action as co-evolving with means rather than being fixed and then means simply adapting to them. Terborn's account, through the affirmations and sanctions model, is essentially what one would call a behaviorist view of how the subjective components of action are formed. That is, it's simple reinforcement. You know, a behaviorist model of learning is that you're rewarded and punished for certain things. And what you learn and your habits and your, the development of your ideas comes from rewards and punishments, simple reinforcement or undermining. And that's what the affirmations and sanctions are all about. It's a very simple learning model of belief formation. I think undoubtedly not an adequate one. That is, the underlying mechanisms at the psychological level are too thin to fully understand how things work. But it's also not a bad first approximation. I think a simple learning model gets you quite far in understanding why people believe what they believe. Why bother with all this? I suppose that's probably pretty clear at this point. I've said it in different ways. You know, at a purely theoretical point of view, a complete theory of ideology simply needs micro foundations. It's simply incomplete. If you black box the problem, then it's just not a complete theory. So just in the spirit that science advances by filling in the gaps, micro foundations of ideology are an important part of the elaboration of such a theory. There's a methodological issue, which is, in the case of theories of ideology, the analysis of the mechanisms is particularly important given the object of explanation, beliefs. To have confidence in our beliefs about beliefs, we do need some knowledge of the causal mechanisms involved. So the study of these underlying mechanisms is part of even the descriptive task of really being clear and understanding of what people actually believe. So your beliefs about beliefs, so to speak, are affected by your understanding of the mechanisms through which beliefs are formed. And then I think from a Marxist or critical point of view, if ultimately we want to transform the world and we believe beliefs, and we believe beliefs, are one of the things which constitute, on the one hand, obstacles to transformation, and on the other hand, a way of facilitating transformation, so that the beliefs of actors are one key component in getting people to engage in struggles for change, and one of the key obstacles to change, to transformation, if you believe that, then understanding how those beliefs are themselves embedded in people's subjectivity becomes important. And ultimately, I think it means that you need a serious cognitive psychology to go along with theories of ideology. And one of the weaknesses of the Marxist tradition has been precisely the weakness of its underlying psychological theory. I say cognitive psychology rather than everything psychology, because I think that the issue of the beliefs and their anchors is the central problem here. A Marxian cognitive psychology may not have any distinctively Marxian character. There need not be any particular, you know, class analysis component to the cognitive psychology itself. It may be that Marxist cognitive psychology meaning a cognitive psychology used to solve Marxian problems, is just straightforward cognitive psychology, that it has no distinctive class content to it. Just as for feminism, a feminist cognitive psychology may not indeed have any distinctively feminist component to it. It may be used for feminist purposes in understanding gender beliefs and their transformation, but there may not be any distinctively feminist dimension to the theory itself. Now, for feminism, I think there probably is a distinctive feminist component, because I think there probably are some gendered aspects of cognition for which feminist theory can give us purchase. I'm much less convinced that there's class distinctive aspects of cognition. That is, in the mechanisms themselves. Of course, there are distinctive class aspects of what people believe. That is, a cognitive psychology inserted into a working class context helps you understand why workers believe what they believe, in contrast to why capitalists believe what they believe. But it isn't that there is a distinctively class-based theory of the cognitive processes involved itself. I don't know if that's clear or not, but yeah.
Would Robert Wade suggest in last night that ultra-rich are less empathetic be an example of that?
But there, if it's true that they're less empathetic, it's because they share with workers a particular cognitive process, which, when that empathy-producing process in a human being is located in a capitalist position, it produces lower empathy levels. Mm. Right?
Yeah. No different mentalities.
If mentality describes the outcome, there are different mentalities. If it's describing the underlying mechanism that produces the outcome, that mechanism is the result of a psychological process interacting with a social context. The Marxian part of the story is the distinctiveness of the social context and why we should worry about that context, ruling class versus working class. But not that there is some Marxian theory of how the brain works that's distinctively Marxist. You know, that now, I mean, I don't know what it would mean. There have been moments in the history of Marxism when Marxists argued that there was a Marxist biology and a Marxist physics. You know, in Stalinism, there was a Marxist evolutionary theory. So Stalin rejected Darwin in favor of Lysenko. It's a famous episode in the history of science. Darwin's evolution is driven by sexual reproduction and the inheritance of traits under conditions of differential fitness. Lysenko's theory of evolution is creatures struggle with their environment and improve in various ways, and that improvement is passed on to the next generation. So in the Lysenkan version, why do giraffes have long necks? It's because a short-necked giraffe struggled to get its neck a little longer, and its descendant had a longer neck, and then it struggled to get its neck a little longer. So Stalin decided that that was the Marxist theory of evolution because it corresponded more to the notion of the development of the forces of production. You know, there's various reasons, and that by striving we could create a better world, etc. And it's ridiculous. There's no reason to believe whatsoever that there's any Marxian theory of biological evolution. Yeah.
I was going to say, not that the theory makes any sense, but epigenetics, I mean, sort of points to like...
Yeah, so there are some shadows of Lysenko that have reemerged and that are very interesting, but they only get their theoretical weight by virtue of their connection to the Darwinian story. And of course, it's super interesting, the epigenetic, you know, the new emphasis on epigenetics and how, indeed, certain kinds of adaptations are passed on. And there's other issues as well. The new, this is total digression. This is digression cubed. The new research on what's called the human biome. So the human biome is the reference to the trillions of bacteria that live in your body. Now these are separate organisms. They have their own DNA. They reproduce in the ordinary way that bacteria reproduce. We all will, because we are all living in this particular environment, will share a lot of the same biome, but everybody has a little bit different mix of these things. Well, it turns out that if, for example, you are an Eskimo, or that's not the term of Inuit, if you're an Inuit family and you live in the Arctic and you eat the diet of walruses and fish and whatever, you develop a very distinctive biome. It's radically different from people who don't live in that environment, and which actually enables them to digest and consume that food in a way more healthy way than we would. That is, we would have huge health problems if we simply went to an Inuit village and started eating the way they eat, whereas they don't have those health problems. Now, the interesting thing is that the babies born in that environment get some of their bacteria directly from the mother. So they are inheriting part of the adaptation that isn't part of the mother's DNA, it's part of the mother's biome. It's kind of, it's not, that's different than the epigenetic thing, but it's in the same spirit. That is, adaptations of the adult are passed on directly to the child. And that's because as an organism, we're not just a DNA organism, we're a whole biological environment internally. Okay. Types of explanations. Now we're getting right into Elster's account. So Jan Elster is a Norwegian philosopher, sociologist, political scientist. He has written a series of, I think, terrifically careful and interesting work. He has an intellectual style of working unbelievably intensely on something, and then moving on to something completely different. So his body of work spans just an amazing variety of topics. And he's pretty relentless. I mean, the book Making Sense of Marx, which I think is, on the one hand, it's really a brilliant piece of erudite work in the sense of so systematically and relentlessly going through every possible theme in Marx and interpreting it in this and reconstructing it in this particular way. So it's fantastic, and on the other hand, it's very frustrating because it's not an even-handed kind of exploration of the different sides of Marx and the values on, and the positive and negatives on different ways of doing it. It's absolutely worth reading. The level of erudition in it, you know, the amount of Marx's work that he has, good facility with is extraordinary. But one shouldn't read it as the authoritative interpretation of what Marx meant. It's pretty close to an authoritative interpretation of what, if you adopt the premises of Elster, you would get from Marx. And a lot of it's super interesting. And I thought among the most interesting parts were his efforts to figure out inside of Marx's own work, what is the implicit cognitive psychology? How should we understand the mechanisms by which these ideologies get produced that are already present inside of Marx's work? But of course, Marx didn't elaborate them this way. All right, so let me just briefly go through some of the big ideas of Elster's approach to the micro foundations of ideologies. First, just a little small point about what Elster is actually trying to explain in his account. His discussion of ideology is a bit narrower than what I've proposed. He defines ideology as beliefs and values that have society as their object as well as their explanation. So that's what an ideology is. It's beliefs and values that people hold, which have as their object society. And I haven't put that as a restriction. So mine, following Terborn, ideologies are just beliefs and values, answers to the question what exists, what is good, and what is possible. But I was comfortable talking about ideologies of nature, for example, whereas Elster wouldn't use the term ideology for that purpose. I don't think much hinges on that restriction, but just so you know, that's what he's talking about. A brief comment on the autonomy of thought. This may be pretty obvious, but it's worth saying that a precondition for microprocesses of ideology to have much interest, why we'd want to even bother with this, is the belief that thoughts have a certain autonomy, that our beliefs have a certain kind of autonomy. If all of our beliefs and thoughts, of everything that's going on in our mental states, were instantaneous reflections of the material conditions in which we lived, so if our beliefs were merely reflections of the context, then there'd be little reason to worry and think about the micro foundations. belief formation is of interest because it is not a simple reflection of the world in which we live. At a minimum, even if all of our beliefs are caused by our social context, at a minimum, they have a certain durability, which means they can influence our action even if the context changes. And that's another form of autonomy of thought. So even if every idea in your head is there because somebody instilled it in it, that is, you have no autonomous processes of belief formation. In my own view is that it's one of the peculiar and extraordinary things about human beings is that we have simultaneously autonomous processes of belief formation through the way we're continually thinking about our own thinking, worrying about our own ideas, reflecting upon our own state of being. So we are processing things actively, not just passively, but we're also being bombarded with ideas that are coming in and sticking. So it's both things going on. But even if we didn't have the autonomous processing, so even if we weren't authors of our own ideas, so to speak, even if that idea was completely gone, as long as ideas have any robustness in explaining actions, any stickiness, they would still have some autonomy. Because once they're embedded, they would continue to affect your action, even if the conditions of their embedding changed. Well, the point about this autonomy of thought is when you hear debates about whether, you know, idealism versus materialism, whether it's material conditions or ideas that have effects, a lot of that ends up being pretty, I think, silly and unnecessary. Or another way of putting it, if you don't believe that ideas have some kind of independent autonomous effects, that is, once people believe them, they have consequences. If you didn't believe that at all, there'd be hardly any point in doing social science if you were a radical. You know, what's the point of trying to change people's beliefs through your writing if you believe that beliefs don't matter? So maybe it's just self-serving to believe in the autonomy of thought. It's a necessary condition to be a serious intellectual that you have such a belief. All right, types of explanations. Now we're getting into the guts of his arguments. And as he does throughout his writing, it's all bound up with making distinctions. The sense in which Elster is thought of as being part of this tradition of sort of Marxian thinking called analytical Marxism. The adjective analytical in the expression analytical Marxism comes from analytical philosophy. Analytical philosophy is a particular way of doing philosophy. It's not a particular content. That is, you can be an analytical philosopher and study anything, and you could hold a wide range of positions on philosophical debates. But what is characteristic of analytical philosophy is a lot of time being spent on making precise distinctions and contrasts so that the setup to a problem is meant to be completely transparent with no hand-waving. And a lot of the criticism by analytical Marxists of certain strands of Marxism, like sometimes identified as Hegelian Marxism, a lot of the criticism is because of the lack of clarity. You know, so when Hegelians invoke the dialectic, it's often just not clear what they're talking about. And when you try to nail down, well, what exactly does that idea mean? What's the difference between a dialectical argument and a non-dialectical argument? How do you know a good, clear one, rigorous one from a sloppy one? You get hand-waving. You don't get clear, incisive distinctions. Well, Elster, that's what he does. Better or worse, he's embedded in the analytical philosophy tradition, and he takes that into his discussions of the specific problems, in this case, consciousness and ideology. So first, different types of explanations. And he has two contrasts. The first is between interest explanations and position explanations. Why do capitalists believe what they believe. One kind of explanation is they believe what they believe because it's in their interests to believe those things. So the ideas that capitalists hold are a consequence of capitalists understanding what's in their interests, and they will adopt beliefs that correspond to those interests. That's one type of explanation. Another is capitalists believe what they believe not because of their interests, but because of characteristics of their positions. That the positions they occupy in the world directly shape their beliefs. Robert Wade's argument that capitalists have an empathy deficit is really a positional argument. It says that by virtue of being isolated from the rest of the world, from living lives of great privilege and just not understanding what it's like to be a person in desperate situations, they lose empathy. Not because it's in their interest to be unempathetic, that's another kind of argument, but because they lost the capacity for empathy by virtue of the nature of their position. That's a positional explanation. Positional explanations may produce beliefs that are quite contrary to one's interests. Right? So it may be, you can easily imagine situations in which an empathy deficit on the part of elites means that they just don't understand the nature of the conflicts that are brewing, and they fail to do things which they could have done to calm things down if they had had empathy for the conditions of life of others. So an empathy deficit can be actually very destructive of the interest, but it's still explained by virtue of their position. Position explanations and interest explanations are therefore very different kinds of explanations. Commodity fetishism is a position explanation. Why do people come to believe that markets have these powers, and why do workers believe, you know, the sort of fetishistic beliefs that are described with that term? It's by virtue of the nature of the positions they occupy, not because it's in their interests or anybody else's interests. Okay, that's the first contrast: interest explanations, position explanations. The second contrast is causal explanations versus functional explanations. Elster, at the time he was writing this book on Marx, was in a protracted debate with G.A. Cohen, who we'll be reading starting next week, who wrote the book Karl Marx's Theory of History of Defense. They're good friends, but also in this very intense and interesting debate, which I was sort of not exactly peripherally involved with, but, you know, engaged with as well, where Elster hated functional explanations. He just trashed them at every possible opportunity. And Cohen was a big defender of functional explanations. He thought that the idea of a functional explanation was absolutely essential to developing a theory of history. And we'll see why he believed that in the next block of the course. Really interesting debate, very productive debate. Well, that's why he put so much emphasis, I think, in this text on that contrast between causal explanations and functional explanations. A causal explanation is a kind of explanation that we're all just familiar with. You know, you have a set of mechanisms which generate effects, and if you've gotten a full account of the way those mechanisms generate the effects, you've explained the effects. So that's a causal explanation. It's through some generative process, some set of mechanisms. The word mechanism is a little misleading. It kind of suggests mechanistic, like clockwork. It just means the generative process that produces the effect. That's what mechanism means. So for example, the argument that rich people lose the mental capacity for empathy, the mechanism is that empathy is developed through people's interactions with people different from themselves, where you develop a feeling for what it would be like to be in their shoes, and that if you live a life that's systematically isolated from those kinds of experiences, your empathic capacity will wither over time. So there's a set of mechanisms that have to do with the way contact and interaction produces intersubjective connection and an ability, et cetera, et cetera. That's a straightforward causal explanation. A functional explanation is an explanation of something by virtue of its beneficial effects. Right? So you explain the existence of something because it has positive beneficial effects. In biology, as I've said, that's standard. Functional explanations, however, also appear in social contexts. So we've got these two contrasts. Yeah?
Okay, I just have a question. I just want to make sure I understand the distinction. Like, in the example of empathy that you keep going back to, so if that's, like, positional, and, like, if it's, like, out of someone's interest in the case of, like, if workers go on strike or whatever because of these, like, bad conditions and because the people can't empathize, but, like, doesn't it also kind of make it easier to, like, exploit people more if you aren't empathetic to their position? Like, is there any overlap?
Right, yeah. So one might argue that low empathy is both functional for capitalists and a result of their position. It could be both. You'd have to give a mechanism by which the functional aspect is selected, why that's the case. And if it's a real functional explanation, then when empathy would be functional, then the empathic ability should suddenly appear. And it should only not be there when low empathy is what's functional. And that's not what we observe. So coincidentally, sometimes low empathy may make it easier to be a bastard and repress workers because you don't empathize with their situation. But it's still, your lack of empathy isn't explained by the fact that in this argument that it's good for you to have low empathy. Yeah.
Where would the idea that people might naturally have different dispositions come in? So, like, maybe it's that people who happen to be born less empathetic are, like, it makes them more likely to become capitalists because...
Right, so, so that would be a whole different kind of argument. That is that empathic capacity is caused by two different processes. A genetic one, let's say, that is randomly in the population, some people are sociopathic and have no capacity by virtue of their hardwiring in their brains to ever empathize with people, and other people are born with a lot of empathic capacity, and many people in between. And then through a process of natural selection and competition, the unempathetic people are able to rise to the top. Right? And that, if that was the mechanism, then it wouldn't have anything to do with the properties of being a capitalist that explains lack of empathy. That would be a correlation that does not reflect causation. It's that you're in the capitalist class because you have no empathy, as opposed to you have no empathy because you're in the capitalist class. So that would be the classic error of confusing correlation with causation. Once you have a stable social order, it seems to me extremely unlikely, in fact, since most capitalists aren't randomly selected, aren't mobile because of randomly distributed traits that happen to select on them. But no, that would be a rival theory. And there could be contexts in which, on the question, do the rules of football lead people to be aggressive, or is it that only aggressive people are going to decide to play football as opposed to tennis or whatever other sports that, they might have done. Yeah?
Well, I think, not just like to labor this point, but I think it could be argued that it's important to be empathetic, to be an effective capitalist, because to exploit people you have to, like, understand their interests and understand, like understand a lot of their, like, inner workings, and that requires empathy.
So this bears on our discussion of hegemony, right? So in the hegemony versus despotism contrast with respect to workplaces, a hegemonic workplace is one in which the dominant classes are leaders and are able to do just what Maddie said. They're able to understand the real interests of workers and figure out ways of accommodating them sufficiently to elicit consent, whereas a despotic boss doesn't give a shit about accommodating interests and is going to deal with it just through coercion. It's one of the contrasts then between capitalism and slavery. That in slavery, the essential way in which slaves were controlled was despotism, not through eliciting their consent. This new movie, I don't know if any of you have seen it, painful as it is, I do recommend it, The 12 Years a Slave, a movie that's now in Madison, an extraordinary film about slavery. It's based on a memoir of an African-American freeman. He was free in New York, who gets kidnapped and sold into slavery. And when he eventually was liberated, this was in the 1840s, he wrote this book, 12 Years a Slave, and that's the basis of the movie. And, you know, it's just the key thing there is he lives under a variety of slave owners, one of whom did have empathic capacity, one of whom felt sympathy or empathy, at any rate, for the conditions of slavery. And that slave master was a way less effective slave master and constantly having trouble. And eventually he had to sell this slave because to protect it's an interesting story, but the slave's life was in jeopardy because of conflicts that slave was having with some whites other than the slave master, and the slave master felt he couldn't protect him any longer, so he had to sell him to somebody who was a more conventional slave master. So empathy caused a lot of problem if you're a slave master. So that's a case where, you know, in the extreme instance, it's probably not that the explanation of the lack of empathy of slave masters is, it could still be made, actually, it still is probably a combination of causal and functional or interest explanations. You know, it's rationalization, but it's also the brutalization of the psyche of the slave master is what destroys their empathy. All position explanations are causal. If it's a position explanation, it is a causal explanation. Interest explanations can be either causal or functional. A belief may be explained because it's shaped by interests or because it serves interests. Those are two different kinds of explanations. You can hold certain beliefs because they are shaped by interests, but not because they actually serve your interests. A belief that is shaped by interests doesn't necessarily serve your interests. There's no inherent reason for functionality to always be produced. Wishful thinking is an example. Wishful thinking is a type of belief you hold. So one diagnosis for why people hold a particular belief is wishful thinking. It's shaped by what's in their interests, but it may not serve their interests. An example of that is in the 1930s, radical workers often believed that the USSR embodied communist ideals. There was this belief that the Bolshevik Revolution had produced a communist utopia. And revolutionary workers in the West often adopted that kind of belief and praised Stalin as a result. Now, this is an example of what I think could be called wishful thinking. The wish is parent to the thought, which is a psychological mechanism. They so desperately wanted there to be an ideal society towards which they could use as a model. Such a society was clearly in their interest if it existed, that they convinced themselves through self-deception that communism as it was embodied under the Stalinist regime did embody these ideals. Now the question is that in their interests or not? It's explained by their interests, but is it actually in their interests? Well, arguably, you know, a good historical case can be made that one of the reasons why the Weimar Republic in Germany collapsed was because of the inability of communists and social democrats to work together. That if they had been able to form a united front against the Nazis would not have succeeded. There was a crucial period in which Stalin declared that social democrats were social fascists, that there was no difference between the social democrats and the Nazis, that they were both agents of imperialism. You know, it's similar to the claim that there's no difference between the Tea Party and Obama, or the Tea Party and liberal Democrats, that they're all of a piece, and that the differences are just mystifying, and therefore we should fight them all, rather than understanding that there can be some dangers that are way worse than others, and some political perspectives which are prepared to use repressive and refuse to seek compromise or accommodation or et cetera. So that set of beliefs on the part of revolutionary workers arguably was generated by interests, but you can't argue that they were functional. So that would be a case of a positional explanation that works through, I mean, an interest explanation that's causal rather than functional. The interests, through a psychological mechanism, wishful thinking, explains the belief Stalin is the head of a communist utopia, which then explains the ideology of the Communist Party in Germany, that above all we must defend the Soviet Union. That's the highest priority because the Soviet Union is the future of the world and our only hope. And if the Soviet Union says that we shouldn't collaborate with the Social Democrats, it's probably right. Right, so that's interest causal explanation. Interest functional explanations are of the form that capitalists believe that socialism is undesirable because it actually serves their interests to believe this. So they have a whole set of beliefs about the undesirability of socialism strictly because this serves their interests. That's an interest functional explanation. And a position causal explanation are explanations we've already explored. My example in the ideologies of nature, sitting on the side of the hill watching the sunset, that's a position causal explanation. Your perception of the sun is strictly a result of your position, and that generates a certain kind of mental state. And then the question is whether that can be countered through other kinds of mechanisms. All right, well, it's 12 o'clock. I guess let me tell you what we're going to do. I will go through 2.3 just to wrap this up, exploring these four specific kinds of mechanisms that Elster talks about. We'll wrap this up at the beginning of Tuesday's lecture, and then we'll launch the theory of history. Okay, see you next week.